It is my happy pleasure today to introduce our speaker, the Reverend Edward Eggert. He's here to talk about ministering to alcoholics, a very important subject indeed. He is a friend, a colleague, and I assure you a very caring and competent pastor with special expertise in the area of giving pastoral care to chemically dependent persons and their families. When we talk about alcoholism, we're talking about something we need to be talking about. It's a serious illness in our society. It ranks with heart disease and cancer. We assume that there are at least 10 to 12 million alcoholics in the United States. We have discovered among teenagers between the ages of 14 and 17 that there are probably 3 1/3 million young people whose drinking seems very alcoholic, and if they are not victims of the alcoholism illness, they're certainly moving in that direction. What shall we say? One out of what? Every 10 or 12 people who drink beverage alcohol in any way become addicted to alcohol. They get into the illness called alcoholism for some reason or another, probably different people for different reasons. Well, we're concerned because alcoholism causes a lot of human suffering, and we are committed to the relief of human suffering. We have the same commitment of our Lord Jesus, who said, "I have come that they might have life, and they may have it more abundantly." We see alcoholism as a sin sickness. There's sin in the causality. Alcoholism certainly destroys people spiritually as well as physically and emotionally and spiritually. And spiritual resources are needed for recovery. It is a progressive illness. It is a fatal illness. There is no cure for the illness, but there is recovery. It takes spiritual resources. Let's go beyond that. It takes religious resources. Let's go beyond that, and we will say it takes the resources of the gospel of Jesus Christ and of the Holy Christian Church. Well, some things about my friend and colleague. Chaplain Eggert is no stranger to St. Louis. A graduate of this seminary. His first pastorate was in Shawnee, Oklahoma, and I like Oklahoma because I spent a bunch of years there myself in Norman. After he left Shawnee, he went to Minneapolis and there worked with the Lutheran Mission Association, serving as a visiting chaplain in two hospitals. Came back to St. Louis and was chaplain at the Robert Koch Hospital. In those days, the folks there suffered from tuberculosis, and many of them were alcoholic people. And there he got into the whole field of alcoholism and served so capably for a long period of time. For a while, he was the executive director of the Council on Alcoholism in St. Louis, and then moved to Lincoln, Nebraska, where he served as the director of the National Council on Alcoholism. And then from there, moved on to his present position. For 13 years, he has served as the director of pastoral care, the DePaul Rehabilitation Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And there he's been able to do all kinds of wonderful ministry. There he teaches. There he preaches. There he does one-to-one counseling. There he does group therapy. There he works with families. One of the newest things now is his work on the adolescent unit, and that really excites me. A new adolescent unit, about a year and a half old. Young people between the ages of 12 and 17 suffering from polydrug dependency with probably an accent on alcoholism, and he told me the average age is 15. Well, at any rate, here is a pastor, and here is a pastor who has so much to share with us, and it is my privilege to welcome and introduce to you Chaplain Ed Eggert and ask you to welcome him with me.
Thank you, Charlie. About a week ago, I contacted my mother, who is 91 years of age and as sharp as she was when she was 60, and told her that I was coming to the seminary to present a lecture here. And this past Saturday evening, she called me. And she said, how do you feel about going back to the seminary? And remember, I graduated in 1950, so there's a few moons have come and gone since then. And I said, well, frankly, I'm a little tense about it. Certainly when I graduated, I didn't think I'd be coming back one day to be at this side of the lectern instead of where I had been for 4 years prior to that. So it's a real thrill for me. And to be in the chapel this morning for the chapel exercises, thinking about the many chapel exercises I had the opportunity to attend when I was a student here. Charlie and I were reminiscing a little bit, and maybe some of you remember some of the real exciting chapel addresses I felt were when dear old Doc Raywinkle used to lead the chapel. And sitting in the chapel this morning, a lot of really good, fond memories came back from some 30 years ago. So it's a thrill to be here this morning. The other reason I'm real excited when Gladys Silfo contacted me early this winter about coming down here, I thought, gee, this is a fantastic opportunity. Because as Charlie indicated, conservatively, I would say we have 12 million alcoholics. But for every one alcoholic, there are at least four other people directly involved in the dependency or the deterioration of that individual, and another four people indirectly involved. So if you multiply 12 by 8, you begin to see the enormity of the problem in the alcoholism in America today. If you take a look at just a few of the statistics about the kinds of people that are going to be coming to your attention as future pastors, in the counseling situation, they estimate nearly 80% of the people who come to you with a divorce situation have an alcohol-related orientation to that problem. If you look at the fatalities today or the deaths in America today, if you include highway fatalities, alcoholism has more people dying of it than heart disease or cancer. One of the other statistics which is really disturbing to me is the tremendously high percentage of clergy with the alcohol problem. We are on a par with the medical profession. For years they have been saying the medical profession has the highest incidence of any professional group. Today they are saying clergy are on an equal with them. So I think you, those of you, future clergy of America, of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think it behooves you to take a real good look at your own personal use of beverage alcohol. Why you use it, when you use it, and in what kind of situations you use it. Or whether you might also begin to take a look at the abstinence is also an alternative for you. To get at this morning with you, I've decided to set up a hypothetical situation with you and kind of work through that with you. A way in which I feel might be most helpful to you when you get into your own parish offices one day. Not that there are more women alcoholics than men, but I'm going to use the situation of the wife of the alcoholic coming to the pastor, because that's the kind of situation you're going to see most frequently today. There are probably as many female alcoholics as there are men today, but we don't see the husband coming to the pastor nearly as frequently about the wife's drinking as we do the other situation, where the wife comes to talk about the husband's drinking problem. And it kind of runs like this. Mary comes to see Pastor John, and she said, Pastor, would you please come to see my husband, Bill? You know, he's just drinking too much. We're having all kinds of problems in the household. Won't you do something? Like somehow you as a pastor should be able to move a magic wand and somehow get Bill to quit drinking. Now, the struggle is, and the Lord was not kind to me. The first alcoholic that came to my attention when I was a parish pastor in Shawnee, Oklahoma, unfortunately was a female alcoholic. Now, the Lord shouldn't do that to a young preacher right out of the seminary. First of all, I knew nothing about alcoholism. At that time, at least, we learned nothing about alcoholism in the pastoral care department at the seminary 32 years ago. Furthermore, she was not a member of my parish. Her husband was a member of my parish. And I should do something for this lady. Well, I'm not going to tell you what I did because I botched it miserably. And I wish I'd have known at that time some of the things that I've learned and by experience and by textbook and by workshops, how I might have dealt with that situation probably more effectively than I did at that time. So Mary comes to see you. And what generally happens, if you're not tuned in to the problem of the alcoholic, you will go as a fine, dutiful pastor, a little bit of a messianic or a complex, well, I'm going to save everybody anyway, and I'm certainly save this guy. And you go there at Mary's request to see Pete. And you say, well, Pete, I'd need to sit down and talk to with you. You know, Mary came to see me. She seems to be concerned about your drinking problem. And he'll smile. I'll let you a little bit. And he said, probably even thank you for coming. I'm happy to know about your concern, Pastor, but, you know, you really don't have to worry about it at all. Oh, I imagine she was telling me about last Friday night. After all, it was a union meeting. It was the 25th anniversary of some guy, and four guys retired, and we drank a little. And, yes, I came home. I was a little blitzed. Nothing serious. Nothing to worry about, Pastor. And you probably say, and you remember I was in church last Sunday. You remember I was at communion the first Sunday of the month. So obviously I'm not an alcoholic. I'm still coming to church. Well, what do? You're shot down. You have no other ammunition other than what Mary has told you. And Pete says, no, it's not true. So you're between a rock and a hard place. Mary says yes, Pete says no, so you just will go on home. You've done what Mary asked you to do. You've gone to talk to Pete. But Pete continues to drink, and his drinking will probably increase for two reasons. He's angry at his wife, a lot of resentment there. Plus, there's also some guilt kicking up. The pastor, at least, has been told that I'm drinking too much. I really better start watching my situation here. So instead of working with Pete, I begin working with Mary. I have to work through a lot of feelings, a lot of struggles, a lot of understanding that Mary has about her husband, about alcoholism and the alcoholic. And remember, Pete wasn't an alcoholic when Mary got married. Well, he maybe drank a little bit, but after all, which German Lutheran doesn't drink a little bit? And he maybe even got blitzed once in a while, and that's not so bad. You know, after all, you drink a little too much once in a while, you're kind of feeling happy. That's not too serious. But after the period of years of marriage, the problems are becoming more and more severe. The verbal and nonverbal communication begins to deteriorate. He becomes much more defensive about any suggestion of even talking about his drinking. He doesn't come home on time anymore. There's some financial problems. Interpersonal relationship, the sexual relationship has deteriorated. She feels very guilty about that. The kids are having some problems. He's probably beginning to miss some work, depending on how long this thing has progressed. And remember, on an average, a wife will allow the continuation of the alcoholism for 15 years before she takes any kind of definitive action. Now, husbands statistically don't wait nearly that long. A husband will put up with an alcoholic wife only about 5 years before he takes some action. But a wife will put up with this kind of unacceptable behavior because of his alcoholism for an average of 15 years. So this thing has progressed considerably before Mary finally comes to talk to you about it. Because in the first part of this thing, she's into the denial and the hiding and the minimizing. Because after all, which one of you gals here today would want to admit that your husband's an alky? Not many of you. There's too much social stigma. And she gets so involved in what I call self-condemnation. Pete wasn't an alcoholic when I got married to him. He was really a nice guy, maybe even a preacher. So something must be wrong that I'm not doing right, is kind of what she's saying. I'm either not cooking the right kind of meals, I'm not doing a good job keeping the house, I'm not a good disciplinarian for the children, I'm not a good economist. And he's already told me time and time again I'm a lousy bed partner. And that's one of the real crucifying statements the husband makes toward the wife. Sometimes when I do have an opportunity to see the husband come in to see me, and I kind of hit him with that one. If he complains about his wife, you know, it's kind of, well, gee, if Pastor, if you had to live with my wife, you know, and you know our sex life is really bad, and I say, well, has your wife been cheating on you? Oh, goodness, no, Mary would never do that. She's the only, you're the only guy she's ever had any relationship with. Well, certainly, no doubt about that. Well, I said, then you must be a lousy teacher. We at least need to kind of get him tuned into what we're talking about, see? So one of the first things I have to do with Mary, and I do this, I have a regular counseling session. I have a session of eight that I work with wives who are coming to see me. We call it a family confrontation, a family intervention procedure. And I take them through a whole series of about eight programs of an hour and a half apiece, in which I'm attempting to get Mary to the point where she can finally begin to motivate this guy or bring him to the reality of his illness, if you will. So the first thing, I have to work through her own self-condemnation, that Mary, you are not the cause of his alcoholism in any way. The only possible way you could be if you could have held him down and literally poured the booze into him over a long period of time, possibly you could have created some, but otherwise there's no way that you are the cause of his drinking. It's his choice to drink or not to drink. So remove yourself, relieve yourself of the guilt of being the cause of Pete's alcoholic behavior. Now, what frequently happens then, the pendulum has been way over here, it's all my fault, and now it swings way over here to what I call self-righteousness and martyrdom. And I need to bring her back to somewhat of a reality there. You know, in the early part, you know, she's into the denial and the hiding and minimizing. And now suddenly, like she'd like to stand up on top of a seminary tower here and preach it to the whole city of Clayton, my husband's a drunk and no good bum. He doesn't support me. He beats the kids. He beats me. He runs around with other women. He doesn't go to work, et cetera, et cetera. And now she notifies her sisters and brothers and her parents and also his parents. You know, that son of yours is no good. I shouldn't have married him, et cetera. And look what a good woman I am. I'm putting up with this. Somebody ought to be giving me a pat on the back. Because look what a great woman I have been putting up with this, and I'm tolerating it, and I'm allowing him to stay in this household. And we say, wait a minute, Mary. That kind of self-righteousness and kind of a martyr attitude is not going to bring him to the reality of his illness. So what you're going to do is drive him to drink even more compulsively than he has before. Because you're stripping him now of all his masculinity, his macho image, if you will, his own sense of individuality, and you're kicking the guilt level even higher, and all you're doing is causing a greater need for him to drink. Because by this time, he's a pretty sharp guy. You know, Alkies are probably the greatest con artists in the world. There are many times when he has probably deliberately set up an argument with Mary. He couldn't think of a good excuse to drink, so he'd come home and make some comment about the way her hair looked or the way the meals were or whatever, just to get her into an argument. See, now she's bitching at me again. Now I got a good excuse to go out and get drunk. So we need to work through that with her. The other thing we need to work through with her, just Mary, tell me exactly what is your concept? How do you perceive an alcoholic or the disease of alcoholism? Well, I would be willing to take odds with you people. If you'd ask average Joe Blow out on the street, what is an alcoholic? They'd probably give you the old stereotyped alcoholic concept that an alcoholic is some poor guy down on, I don't know, where's Skid Row in town, Olive Market, someplace down there. Some poor guy staggering around down there, sucking out of his brown bag, lost his job, lost his family, probably already got a big gut, cirrhotic liver, et cetera. He's living in the mission house or getting a room down to Sally. And that's the alcoholic. And I said, whoops, Mary, that's not the right image of an alcoholic. That's only about 4 or 5% of the alcoholic population in America today. The rest of them are living out in suburbia, out here in Clayton, University City, and Richmond Heights, and wherever, I forget all the suburbs around here. And I said, the alcoholic is a guy who's still going to work regularly, he's coming home regularly, he's paying a lot of his bills, he's living on Mortgage Avenue, he's maybe even still going to church. And she says, yeah, but, you know, maybe Pete's really not an alcoholic. After all, he doesn't drink every day. And I said, well, how much he drinks, when he drinks, where he drinks is immaterial. There's a little pamphlet that's been put out. It's entitled, I Can't Be an Alcoholic Because. God, the name of Dave Hancock wrote it. And he has all these rationales. I can't be an alcoholic because I drink only beer. Well, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I went to prep school at St. John's when there was only 3-2 beer in Kansas at that time. And I won't tell you how I know, but you can get intoxicated on 3-2 beer. I'll just ask you to accept that on faith. Or they said, I can't be an alcoholic because I don't drink until after dinner. Well, suppose the guy's working second shift or third shift. Now when's afternoon or morning for him? So I said, no, Mary, that doesn't make any difference. And I can't be an alcoholic because I don't drink every day. I only drink on weekends. Well, that doesn't make any difference. You know, you may be a plateau drinker. You may be a periodic drinker. You may be a weekend drinker. You may be a paycheck drinker. When you drink, makes no difference. It used to be when I first got into this business, they used to say I can't be an alcoholic because I'm not past 45. And when I first got into this business, that was kind of the magic age. Under 45, you can't be an alcoholic. And now we're seeing alcoholics at 7-8 years of age. And we say, how is that physically possible? Because the other thing we used to say, it takes 8 or 10 years for the men for a dependency drinking before you become an alcoholic. You women can do it a little faster. It only takes you about 6 or 8 years. And here we're seeing these kids coming in at 12 years of age in our treatment center. They're full-blown alcoholics. We said they haven't lived long enough. But they had. Fill the pulpit for him once in a while. And this particular gentleman had come to see me about a year and a half ago because of the insistence of his wife, because his wife felt that the man had a drinking problem. I saw the man, and I gave him what I frequently do is and I'll let a copy with Charlie if some of you might be interested. It's called the Michigan Alcoholism Scale. It's 98% accurate in determining chemical dependence or not. And I administered this particular little test to this guy, and he flunked it miserably. I said, hey, friend, there's no doubt. And he told me some of the other things that had happened in his life, some of the personal things. I said, there's no doubt you're hooked. Why don't you get in and do something about it? No. He wasn't that bad. Well, how bad is bad? He agreed he would get involved in AA. So I contacted a person up in his particular area of the community, and I said, hey, would you go see this guy? He's willing to go to an AA. He made 3 meetings, then he decided he didn't need it anymore. After all, he was cured. About a year and a half after that, I get a frantic call on a Wednesday morning. He said, Ed, I've got to see you. And I said, well, let me check my date book. I checked out, and I said, okay, how about Friday afternoon? He said, no, I mean today. He said, I can't see you today. I'm booked up. I've got to see you today. I said, okay, we'll have lunch together. I'm a brown bagger. I said, bring your sandwich, and we'll have sandwich in my room, in my office. And this was his story. Remember, this was Wednesday morning, or Wednesday noon now when I'm seeing him. And he said, I woke up this morning, and I couldn't recall whether I had preached that service at that church on Sunday. I was scheduled to be there, but I don't know whether I was there or not. I don't remember anything about it. And he was too embarrassed to call to see whether or not he had been there to conduct the service or not. Well, I contacted some people later, and I found out he had been there, done a nice job, had driven home, which is about 50 miles from there, remembered nothing of the incident whatsoever. That's the blackout. Oh, in a blackout, you don't pass out. You look as perfectly normal. Any one of you could be in blackout right now, and there would be no way of anybody knowing about it. It's one of the early onsets of alcoholism. Social drinkers don't have blackouts. Drunks don't have blackouts. Alcoholics have blackouts. The defensiveness the guy has about his drinking, the minimizing, the beginning to, well, the wife is on me day after day for my drinking, so I'll drink when she doesn't see me. I changed oil in my car 14 times in the last week and a half because I got a bottle out there. I sharpened my wife's knives and scissors down the basement 12 times in the last week and a half because I got a bottle down there. I got a bottle any place I need one, but my wife doesn't see me drinking. She can't understand what's going on with Pete. He looks as drunk as everybody. He never drinks anymore. Well, he's been hiding his bottles. One of the early onsets of alcoholism. One of the other things we see, particularly in the younger guys, is the sexual impotence. It just blows their mind. Gee, here I am, 25, 30 years of age. I'm full of them and bigger and macho. But I can't keep an erection. And they can't understand what's happening. Sexual impotence is not at all uncommon with chemical dependence. And when you add some other drugs with it, it's even more pronounced. So we say, well, Mary, you know, all these things are happening. You've given me 14 different symptoms that your husband's alcoholic. How many symptoms do you need? You know, if you got pneumonia, you got an elevated temp, you got pain in the chest, you're coughing, and the doctor says you already got some fluid in and you've got some rattles, obviously you got pneumonia and you better do something about it. You don't wait till, and you don't say, well, give me one shot of penicillin and I'm done. No, you want some penicillin every day. You really want to get this pneumonia under control. Well, your husband is as sick as that, and he's in danger of either ending up in a psych unit someplace with a burned-out brain, or he'll either be dead by having killed somebody else or somebody will kill him. So, Mary, how about doing something now? How do we go about this? I'd like to describe for you now, in the next few minutes, what I refer to as the family intervention process. It was developed by a guy by the name of Vern Johnson. Maybe some of you have read his book. You got a lot of money here at the seminary, you might want to buy his film. There's 3 films, 45 minutes each. I think you can get them for something like $750, $800, something like that. But they're really worth having around. And if you get out into the community, get in touch with your council on alcoholism, your mental health units, many of them would have these films because they're outstanding in the family intervention process. Keep in mind, I have been working with Mary probably 8 weeks by this time, for an hour and a half a week. Trying to get her to the point where emotionally she can begin to take some action, where she's willing to do something to give him the realistic ultimatum. It's either got to be booze or the family. And sometimes I have to help Mary to understand how far her own self-worth has decreased by this time. I say, for example, Mary, what are you worth to your husband on a daily basis in a dollar and cents way? What would it cost your husband if you had to hire a cook and a housekeeper and a laundress and a disciplinarian and an economist and a mistress? What would it cost? Can we say $100 a day conservatively? Yeah. And you're willing to let your husband live with you for $10, $12, $15 worth of booze a day? And he's saying, hey, the booze is worth more important, is more important to me than you. Are you willing to trade 12 for 100? You begin to see, Mary, what's happened to you. Your self-worth and your self-confidence has deteriorated to such an extent that we need to get some help for you. Because for Mary to confront her husband is no good. It's one-upsmanship. Mary makes this comment, he denies it. She makes a comment, she denies that. And here I'm sitting in the middle, all I'm doing is listening to this little ping-pong ball go back and forth. And I said, Mary, we're going to bring in all the, we call them now significant others, don't we? Well, Mary's got four children. So I said, okay, can we get all the children involved? Do they all know about Dad drink? Oh, no doubt about it. Three of them have already moved out. They can't put up with him anymore. And the last one can't move because she's still a junior in high school. How about anybody else? How about his parents? Well, mother's still alive. Dad's gone. Anybody else? Well, the last intervention I did, we got the pastor involved. And when the wife said, well, the pastor knows. I said, how's the pastor know? Well, the pastor caught the guy in the vestry drinking the sacramental wine. That's a pretty good indication that that's not just social drinking, right? This particular church had 4 gallons of sacramental wine, and one day there's only one left. He was willing to admit to one. He copped out to one, but he said he knew nothing about the other three. So the pastor was involved in this particular family intervention. But what I do, I said, okay, Mary, next week I want you to bring all these people in that have some specific one-to-one awareness of your husband's drinking. As many as you can. Okay, fine. We set up an appointment. Now the four children are there. In this case, the pastor was there, the uncle was there, and the next door neighbor and his wife were there in this particular one. All of them said, we'll be able and we're willing to help. Now, that's a little tough because how many neighbors, how many non-relatives really want to get involved? If we can help them understand how critical this problem is, hopefully we can help them. So I met with all these people and I outlined why we're going to do this and why this was important. They were all willing to be committed. We're going to do this. I said, okay, between now and next week, we'll meet again next week, I want all of you to make a list of every possible situation you can recall where there was any kind of a negative experience between you and Dad or your parishioner or your nephew, whatever, as a result of alcohol. And you have to be able to document this. You can't just say generalities. Well, I can remember one time last summer we all wanted to go fishing. Baloney, that doesn't work. You got to say on the 1st of July of 1981, we wanted to go fishing at Mille Lacs Lake or wherever it happened to be, and you couldn't go or you fell out of the boat or whatever. You have to document. If it was Christmas, you have to say which Christmas, what happened, what was the situation between me and thee. Are you willing to do that? Yeah. Be sure you document it. Write it all down. Don't skip anything. If there's some situation that you feel is too traumatic, too embarrassing, fine, bring it in. Because remember, we have to create a pain situation. We have to confront him. We have to break through his whole denial system so he can no longer say, well, I only drank once here and maybe once there, and I got a little blitz that time, and yeah, maybe I got a little rough here. No, we need the whole panorama of every situation we can bring to his attention. Then when they do that, we say, okay, now next week we're going to get together and we're going to role play this thing. I'm going to play the role of the father as you people begin to read your lists. Now, I generally have the wife read the list last. Now, that's important, people, I feel, because, you know, up until now, it's just been kind of a contest between the husband and wife. And if the wife is anywhere past 35, they immediately has an excuse, but, well, pastor, after all, you know, up there, I learned a new word in Milwaukee, Charlie. Up in Wisconsin, women don't have menopause. Did you know that? In Wisconsin, particularly Milwaukee, women have changes. So he says, well, my wife is having her changes. And the first time I heard that, I thought, what in the world is that? You know. Well, she's in her changes. You know, women get a little dingy anyway when they're in their changes. So we have to have some support for the wife so the husband can't just say, well, my wife's a little kooky. You know, she's a little emotional right now. Pastor, you understand wives, don't you? Well, yeah, I've had one for 32 years. And then there are times when I'm not sure I understand. But we have the children read the list. We have everyone else who is involved read the list. And now I say, okay, now when are we going to confront Dad? Well, we have to do this sometime when he's most sober. So this particular guy, she says, well, it's going to have to be on Saturday morning, early. I said, what do you mean by early? Before 9 o'clock, because on Saturday he starts drinking at 9. I said, okay, how about 8 o'clock? He'll be up? Sure. 8 o'clock, okay. All of us met with the children, of course, who lived in the house. They were already there, but they didn't tell Dad anything about this. And the rest of us met at Dunkin' Donuts, about 3.5 blocks from there. The pastor met there, and the uncle and aunt and the neighbors and I, we met there. So in mass, we drive up to this place, and we walk in, and he says, what's going on? I had not met this man. I introduced myself to him, told him who I was, why I was there, that I had met with his wife quite a few times, I had met with the family, all the other people we had met together, and we would like to sit down and visit with you for a while and try to help you understand the concern these people have for you. And out of their loving concern for you, they want to see whether we can't convince you to seek some help for that which they feel has been the problem here. So far, I have said nothing, and I've never mentioned the word alcoholism. Because the moment I say we're here because we think you're an alcoholic, the red flag goes up. And he's on the defense immediately. We just say we wanted to see whether we can help you with the concern that they feel is a problem. And I said, now, what we're going to do, these people have all produced a list. Now, I would like for you to just kind of sit here and listen to this for a while. You're going to have an opportunity to respond or for some rebuttal, but I would appreciate if you just let them read the list, and then you will be given an opportunity. Is that okay? Well, what can you say? We've ganged up on him, and the biggest son sat at the door so he couldn't walk out on us. And the children begin to read this list. Well, the one daughter is her senior year in university. And she began to read the list, and he exploded. She's the only daughter. How can you say this? You know, look what I've done for you. I've given you a university training. I even bought you a car for Christmas. I said, wait a minute. Your agreement was that you are going to let everyone read the list. You will have an opportunity to respond. And then you can ask Susie about the gift that you've given her. And whether there's any relationship at all about the gift that you've given her and the things that she's saying to you. Okay, we get him calmed down and we start over. Now, folks, this is a very emotionally charged setting, believe me. And remember, I've worked through them and I've confronted them pretty hard the way I kind of assumed their dad might confront them. And I try to get them plugged in. Now, don't lose your cool. It's very emotional. There's a lot of crying, a lot of tears. That's all right. We met with this man at 8 in the morning and it was 2:30 in the afternoon before we got him to go to the hospital. The other thing I do, before we do this, I've already got a bed reserved for him at the hospital. And we've already checked out his insurance, that the insurance would cover it. Wisconsin, I don't know what it is in Missouri, but Wisconsin, we have a fortunate law up there that says all group insurance programs must include alcoholism. So we checked with his insurance. Insurance would cover it. The wife had a bag packed already, and I had a bed reserved at the hospital. So, you know, it'd be terrible. We get him all set to go, and then I call the hospital and say, we don't have a bed, because that happens frequently at our place. And the thing which finally broke the man down, his youngest daughter was 7 years of age. She was sitting at the mother just grasping her arm for dear life as though her life depended on it, and the tears were rolling down this poor kid's face. And just before the mother read, I asked her whether there's something you have to say to Daddy. And I wish that I had it on tape. I'd like to play it at every family intervention. She began to say, Daddy, I love you, but I'm afraid of you. And he, what are you afraid of? Said, I'm afraid you'll kick me again. She said, I've never kicked you. She said, Daddy, you kicked me a lot of times. You kicked me under the bed a lot of times. And she still had the bruises to show it. He just couldn't believe what he was seeing and what he was hearing, that he had kicked his 7-year-old daughter so severely that she still had the bruises on the side of her body and her leg. That was the thing that broke him down. He says, okay, I'm willing to go. If there had been no intervention, the man would still be out there drinking. Some of you might say, well, what's the value of intervention? Because sometimes in intervention, they'll go simply because they feel they're trapped. So what good is it for them to go if they don't want to go? Two things happen. Number one, we get them dried out. We put them in our detox unit for 3-4 days. We get them dried out before we send them up to the rehab unit. So we get him dried out. We make it possible for his mind to begin to function clearly so he can do some rational, logical thinking and his memory begins to function again. That's the first thing. We get some food into his belly again. And while he's in therapy, we've got 104 patients at the hospital. Almost all of our staff are recovering chemically dependent people themselves. So he's constantly rubbing shoulders and communicating and interchanging with people who have been where he's been. And for the first time, some of the fear is relieved. My goodness, you mean I'm not the only guy in Milwaukee like this? And I said, not hardly. We run about 1,500 people a year through here. And we've been in operation out there since 67. Most of our staff are recovering. People, look where they are today. They were where you are one day. And he begins to recognize that his situation isn't so unique and not so hopeless at all. And he begins to trust, and he begins to risk. And then I get involved in the thing very directly with him in the spirituality of the program, particularly the lectures on step 2 and 3. Step 2 says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself has to restore me to sanity. You know, he's been depending on his own willpower all this while. We have one counselor out there, he's a little on the crusty side, but he gets his message across. And sometimes when one of these big, tough, macho guys comes in and says, well, I can do it on my own, I got my own willpower. And his favorite analogy is, next time you have diarrhea, just shut it off with willpower. But we also have to get them plugged into the third step now. You know, when we begin to transfer that dependency to something other than himself again, the third step says, I turn my life and my will over to the care of God, as I understand it. In the fourth step, we help him through an inventory process. Took a little searching, moral, and fearless inventory of myself. And in the fifth step, I admitted to myself, to God as I understand him, and another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. And in step 6 and 7, we are willing to have this power greater than ourselves relieve us of all of our shortcomings. The whole process of self-absolution, if you will, that for once I can begin to relieve myself of the condemnation of all the past, and I can begin to recognize that the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ is there to forgive me of all my sin. And then there, we need a maintenance program through prayer and meditation. I improve this conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. The National Council on Alcoholism has an interesting motto. It simply says, the alcoholic is a sick person in need of treatment and worth treating. The one story in the New Testament which I think describes this whole process most beautifully is the story of the prodigal son in Luke 15. So there's no doubt in my mind but the prodigal was an alcoholic. And what that alcoholic, that prodigal needed, as every alcoholic needs, is a sense of love, forgiveness, and acceptance. And this father in that story gave him the whole bundle in the most beautiful manner. I think that becomes a job of you as a future clergy, and I think it's my job in the Chemical Treatment Center in Milwaukee. I'd like to stop there now. What do we have, another 30 minutes approximately?
Yeah.
Maybe some of you people have some questions, some comments. You're allowed to disagree with me. I won't recognize you if you do, but... Charlie has a comment.
Just a couple of announcements before we get into the questions and answers. First of all, what a gift of Christ to his church, and what a blessing for Ed to be here today. Pastor Eggert is willing to be up in Pritzwalk from about 1 to 2 this afternoon. If any of you would like to drop by and chat with him, he would be most happy to welcome you and receive you and rap with you. Then again, this evening at 7:30, the convocation will continue here, and Dr. Hinchke and I will join Chaplain Eggert in providing a panel. So hope that you will come and bring others at 7:30. Now for some questions and answers. You can have it back.
Okay. Anybody else have a question? It gets to be really tough. Particularly if the multiple happens to be the father and the mother. And the only people you have to work with initially are the children. Because the children are so dependent upon the parents for a home, financial support, whatever. You know. And without some significant others to work with, It's a really tough job. If someone has come to me, I'll say, okay, if you can bring them to me, I'll be happy to talk to them. But I don't go to them, whether there's a husband or wife, unless somebody who, in a sense, is making the accusation is willing to go along with me. Because I have, in a sense, no ammunition other than what somebody has told me. And that's not enough in working with the alcoholic. I need some concrete evidence. So if I just walk into your house and say, well, your son called and asked me to see you because of your drinking problem, you can invite me out in a rather crude manner, and I have no right to come to see you, have I? So I have to have someone who is willing to go along with me and say, hey, Dad, I brought Chaplain Niggert over because I'm really concerned about your drinking, and Ed does some work out at DePaul with alcoholism. Would you at least be willing to talk to him for a little while? But without some support who is willing to go with me, I see no value in going. Does that help?
Yeah.
It doesn't. I'm sure it doesn't answer your question, but I think you're lost. Because if you were the alcoholic and I'd come to you, you would invite me out right quick, wouldn't you? Or you'd have a rationale as to whoever said that doesn't know what he's talking about. Or one of the other common ones is, you know, well, here frequently, well, you know, my wife's father's an alcoholic, and my wife just thinks not anybody who ever has a drink is an alcoholic. So, Pastor, sure, I drink a beer once in a while. But who doesn't? You know, so what can I say? See? So I see no particular value, no help that I can offer, unless somebody's willing to stand there and substantiate the fact that, yes, in fact, you have a drinking problem. Because I don't know. I've never seen you. How can I come in and make any kind of accusation? Yeah?
Your whole approach seems to be based on the idea of direct confrontation with the individual. You haven't said anything about the power of prayer or the direct intervention of the Holy Spirit through word and sacrament. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah. Until the alcoholic is sober, to me, it's like pouring water down a rat hole. Because he's not receptive yet. And I think I have to make him somewhat receptive. I use the analogy, I'm an old farm boy from Nebraska. And, you know, in the spring of the year, we didn't go out and just plant the corn out in the field. We prepared the soil first. And I think the same is true with the alcoholic. If I would come in, for example, let's say you've just been admitted to the hospital. I come into your room, I introduce myself as a chaplain. And I say, well, now, we have all these things available to you. We have chapel on Sunday morning, we have Bible class on Tuesday evening, and I'll notice on your chart, you're Lutheran, surely you'll be there, or whatever, or even offer prayer. You have to remember that when the alcoholic comes into the hospital, he is so guilt-ridden that anything I suggest to him immediately kicks up that guilt level even more. So first of all, I think I need to get him to the point where his thinking is somewhat rational again, plus the pain of the physical withdrawal is gone, so he's in a mood even to hear what I'm saying, and he begins to sense that I really have some concern for him, because the alcoholic is an extremely perceptive individual. And so I think we don't start with the word and sacrament. We establish a relationship first. Then he becomes receptive.
I think it's good to establish the relationship, but if it's true that they have such a high level of guilt awareness, aren't they ready to hear the gospel and hear about forgiveness and deliverance?
Not until they get themselves straightened out a little bit. Yeah. At least it's been our experience. I have a chapel program there, and we have people coming back 6, 7, 8 years since they were in treatment. Well, while they're in treatment, they didn't come to chapel. They have to begin to feel their own sense of self-worth, their own sense of forgiveness has to take place. Not totally, but at least it has to begin. Yeah. I don't feel that I've ever been at all successful in a sense trying to minister in a direct word and sacrament until after I've established a relationship. Yes, sir.
In your analogy a while ago about Mary and the fact that she came to you to say, my husband has a drinking problem, he drinks too much or any of that, I'm wondering, is there a step before that when we can help Mary see that there is a problem instead of making her wait the full 15 years before she comes to seek help, before she takes some definitive action. Is this something we
can
do this
week? I think there is. I'm not aware that much of it is being done. For example, I think you guys ought to preach about alcoholism once in a while from your pulpit. I think you ought to talk about it in your youth groups. I think you ought to have some recovering people come in and address your youth groups. I think you ought to talk about it in Ladies' Aid, LWML, Men's Club, or whatever. I think the people in your parish ought to have some idea of what your concept of chemical dependence is, whether you're at all accepting or whether you're very judgmental or whether you're a very condemning person. And I think if the people in the parish sense that you are a very feeling-sensitive individual, they'll come to you before the 15 years. The other thing I hear over and over, I ask them, well, have you been to see the pastor? No, you know, he's so busy. Baloney. If some way we could get the message across to our people that we're never too busy to hear from our people. But somehow we've created that image. We're all such busy guys. Well, if we're too busy to minister to people, we oughtn't be there. Because that's my job in the first place. At least my own personal feeling about it. There was a question. Okay.
One comment. When the alcoholic doesn't recognize the fact that he has a problem, and he's still feeling that guilty drinking because of the guilt, you're in essence laying the law on by telling him, you know, you have a problem and you feel it's specific. So you are doing the law gospel situation. You are giving the law so he recognizes his sin. Then you can help him with the gospel, with the forgiveness, with the, you know, that kind of thing. So I think in reference to what Paul was saying, there is a law gospel situation going on.
We don't verbalize it to that extent.
Right. Yeah, you don't say this is the law, that kind of thing, but that is a law gospel situation. Also, I guess you said before that in a multiple family, multiple alcoholic family, do you work the same way? I mean, with the intervention thing with the children?
Yeah, if I have someone else to work with.
Okay,
yeah.
But it's much more limited?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, it takes, it's a lot more difficult to get, let's say you got three or four children to work with, and maybe they're still living at home. How do you, you know, let's say, motivate them to be willing to confront their father and mother? And what leverage do they have? Really very little. So if you don't like it, you can leave. So where do they go? See? But if you got the mother or the father, and I say I'm only using the one situation because more frequently it's the mother or the wife that comes, but you got some leverage there. See, the one situation I can recall where we weren't very successful at all, and the whole family and I stayed there while the wife packed his bags and said, okay, if you don't want to get into treatment, you can move out. And her brothers and her father and his parents stayed right there and watched the wife pack his stuff and said, okay, now get out. Well, it took a week, and he finally decided, well, gee, I guess Gail's not going to let me back in. I guess I better go into treatment. But she thought, or he thought, well, after another day, she'll break down. But we had done some good groundwork with Gail beforehand, and Gail went and changed the locks on the house, so he couldn't get in. So he finally had to, he say, the whole family. And the other thing, he was a wife beater. Gail was very afraid. That's why she had the locks changed. What's going to happen if Gary comes back? So before he left, then we said, by the way, Gary, Steve, that's Gail's brother, is going to be staying right here. And the other brother jogs. He's going to be jogging by here every day to see that you're not in the house. Because if there's any problems with Gail, we're going to come looking for you. That's heavy. But we have to create enough pain to hopefully motivate him to some action.
One other thing, what did you separate?
That's almost an impossible question because, you know, what do you mean by success? We do know that we see more people come in through family or industrial intervention than in any other way. And if we can, that's one thing I didn't get at, but if we can use industrial intervention along with the family intervention, we got a real clout here. And we have quite a few industries in Milwaukee area now who are willing to become involved in industrial intervention. Where, let's say you're the employee and there's some indication that you have a drinking problem, they'll come to you one morning and say, hey, John, we've arranged for a bed at you at DePaul. You can be admitted this afternoon at 2 o'clock. And they say, no, no way. So, well, you have a choice. You can either go admitted or here's your pink slip. No questions asked. But they've also worked out with union and management in advance. So the guy says, well, I'll go to my union steward, I'll get you. Oh, no. Union and management are agreed on this. And it's that's probably the most effective intervention. The other one we see happen very frequently when the wife files for divorce. You'd be amazed at the number of guys come charge in and say, Chapel, won't you help me? Well, I just got a divorce. Up there, we call it the blue slip. The divorce decrees are come out in nice blue paper. Do something. I didn't think she'd ever do it. Well, she'd been warning you for 5 years, but I didn't think she'd ever do it. And boy, they come charging in. Yeah. So, oh, yes, sir.
Is it possible physically for a person to drink alcohol for a long time without becoming an alcoholic?
Yes. Just the imbibing of alcohol does not create the alcoholic.
Even though they would consume large amounts of alcohol?
Possible. I wouldn't try it. I don't recommend it.
I know.
For example, I came out of a German-Saxon background where there was a lot of beer drinking. My father made homebrew beer every fall. There was a lot of beer drinking. But I can, in retrospect, recall only one man in the community that was really alcoholic, from what I understand about alcoholism today. But beer drinking was just... Every afternoon, you know, we'd have lunch at 4 in the afternoon, and we'd have a bottle of beer with lunch. Well, I don't know what you mean by excessive, or a lot of drinking. You know, what's excessive to you may be just not important to me at all, or maybe the other way around. Because I think that's why social drinking is not considered alcoholism, see? For you, just because of some social event, you decide to have a drink, and you may do that every day. But see, your normal body, assuming your body is healthy, you can oxidize or neutralize 1 ounce of alcohol per hour. So if you never drink more than that, you shouldn't have a problem with the alcohol. But show me an alcoholic that's willing to have one drink an hour or one beer a day. You know, I used an illustration one day in my group. I said, my wife and I split a beer last night with some cheese and crackers. It was the most hilarious thing they ever heard of. Who ever heard of splitting a beer? Yeah.
Do we have any understanding of why some do and some others don't, and they might drink the same amount of alcohol?
Probably the same reason you smoke and your buddy doesn't. I think all of us learn some way of dealing with our own tension. Some people have learned to deal with tension in an acceptable way. Some people learn to deal with tension when it's maybe only harmful to you but not to others. Alcoholism, to me, is a learning process. You discover that the alcohol relieves tension, it creates euphoria. Next time you have to, I was going to say preach a sermon, but I better not use that. Don't drink before your sermon. But you have to, whatever you're doing, and you're under a lot of tension, and you discover you have a martini or two, and geez, everything seems to kind of fit in place. You don't feel tense, you're not so sweaty in the palm of your hand, you don't have dryness of the mouth, and you can just kind of move right along. And unfortunately, you learn, kind of like Pavlov's dog learned, that if you drink 4 martinis, you're going to get relief in 20 minutes and it's going to last you an hour and a half. So why drink only 1 martini when 4 will do it faster and last longer?
The reasons behind drinking more.
Yeah, I think the effect for which you drink. See, that's why when people say, I drink because I just love the taste out of it, I say, that's a bunch of baloney. After the third drink, you don't taste anything anyway. Because you've anesthetized your taste buds by that time. You can't taste what you're drinking. In all due respect to Budweiser, you can't tell whether you're drinking Budweiser or Schlitz Light. All you can tell that it's cold. So you drink for effect. And when you begin to drink for effect, then I think you're on thin ice. Question back here.
Yes, two questions. Assuming that we are basically aware, how far can we, as pastors, carry this process before we have to find your phone number and give you a call?
Oh. Okay, let me answer that one first. That's a good one. I think wherever you guys go in your first assignment, get acquainted within the first week of community resources. The first week, get acquainted with community resources. Where's your mental health committee? Where's your Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Where's your Al-Anon meeting? You know, the Al-Anon is for the non-alcoholic member of the family. Where's your Al-Teen meeting for the teenage kids? If you can find an AA member in the community, go and introduce yourself to him. He can be a tremendous resource, or she can be a tremendous resource to you. If, particularly if he's willing to have him, you break the anonymity. So let's say first week you're over there, and here comes Mrs. Schmaltz, and she says, "Pastor, my husband got a drinking problem." Well, I said, "Well, I don't know too much about this, but hey, I know a guy who does." And you've already checked out with Ed Eggert, the alcoholic in the community, and said, "Hey, Ed, I've got a live one here. Would you be willing to come see him? Can I send him to you?" Absolutely. Fine. But you can't do that unless you got his permission because of the anonymity of the program. But you ought to get acquainted with all the good resource agencies in your community. Okay, second question. Very carefully. I think we have to help her to understand that, not all of the problems in the household are alcohol related. And even though she's not the cause of the drinking, as I mentioned a while ago, maybe the things that she's doing make it unnecessary for him to do anything about it. For example, nagging at him is not going to undo the situation. Giving him the silent treatment is not going to undo the situation. Flipping from one extreme to the other. Now, one day she says, "Well, I'm going to love this guy so much that he just have to do it." And the next day, the next week, whenever, you turn over your back and the old proverbial backache, headache, or whatever that she practiced, actually, total rejection. All these flip-flopping from one extreme to the other only adds to his confusion. And you have to begin to recognize that you have some responsibility in this situation. So don't be putting all the projection or of all the blame, the guilt over there. You have some responsibility in this. One of your responsibilities, Mary, is to get as much information as you possibly can about alcoholism and the alcoholic so you can be helpful in an effective intervention. So you can't just run away from it and say, "Well, it's his problem." Run that by again. What was your question now?
What kind of problems crop up, say, when the wife agrees to no longer be the neighbor or
rescuer? Oh, okay. This begins to happen as she really gets involved in Al-Anon, because Al-Anon helps her to understand what they refer to as the process of detachment, that you don't become emotionally involved, because the Al-Anon use, in a sense, the same 12 steps that they do. I am powerless over the alcoholic, and my life is the unmanageable. It'll probably help him come to the reality of his problem more quickly. If she no longer rescues him, he has to begin to see that, hey, something's happening here. And it's not uncommon that a guy will get involved in AA after his wife is in Al-Anon for a while, because he no longer has somebody to rescue him. And when he no longer has a rescuer and a neighbor, he has to begin to assume or face the responsibility of his alcoholic behavior, doesn't he? And that's why it's important to withdraw all, and I mean all, support of this guy, physically, emotionally, financially. You pull the crutches out from under him. Let him fall. The harder, the better.
Yeah, there's some questions on that side.
Okay, I'm sorry. Got one, a hot one over here. Go ahead, with the red shirt. Well, he's probably been violent in the past, number one, because physical violence in the alcoholism family is very common. But I think we have to help her to understand that she has some legal rights. And she may have to remove herself, her own physical self-protection. She may have to call the police. But the problem we have so frequently, she'll call the police, and when he gets there, then she'll withdraw the complaint. That's the other thing which frequently happens, because she knows she chickens out. And we try to help her to say, no, if it's the situation so severe that you have to call the police, then sign a complaint. Let him facing the judge, paying the fine. It's one more thing to pull the crutch off from under him. Yes, over here. Yeah. Yeah.
So you do not actually treat this illness. For example, if I get diarrhea, I don't ask for it. I don't go looking for it. I don't learn how to get it.
Yeah.
So you would have to treat my diarrhea different from my alcoholism. Yes.
Do you think an alcoholic asks for alcoholism? Is this what you're suggesting?
Right.
They don't. I've never yet met an alcoholic that wanted to become an alcoholic. Because it's a very painful, expensive process to become an alcoholic. It's hard work to become an alcoholic. You're right. The American Medical Association, by the way, it wasn't the clergy. It wasn't the church. It was the American Medical Association that first termed it as an illness as recent as 1956. But when they say it's an illness, they say it's, as Charlie mentioned a while ago, it's a physiological, psychological, and spiritual. Now, which came first is immaterial, but all three of them are there by the time we see them. And I think when in the treatment process, we have to do it's almost in a reverse order of what I said. I think we've got to get their belly straightened out and their heads screwed on right before we get at the spiritual aspect of it. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know your name. Go ahead.
I have two questions. I'll ask the easier one.
Okay, that's good.
I have a casual acquaintance who I remember at one time had somebody said to me, oh, he's got problems with alcohol. He's an alcoholic. And then...
It's certainly possible. I'm trying to think of anything offhand. In the withdrawal process, for example, we see seizures frequently. There are some people say, well, he's epileptic. He has epileptic seizures. That may be, but we do know that if the individual, even on, if he's on medication for his seizures, he may be on probanthine and Dilantin, but if he drinks, it's going to negate the effect of that medication and he'll have seizures more frequently. So you may have an alcoholic seizure in addition to the epileptic seizures. That's the one thing I'm just trying to think of something where we would see some direct similarity. I'm not yet another. I really don't know much about that.
The next question is, as you were mentioning, most of us come out of a Lutheran Saxon background where at least sober drinking and beer and everything is fairly well accepted and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think it depends a lot on the kind of importance you yourself place on alcoholism. You can check it out. I understand quite a few people are married now. That was verboten when I was here. If you invite some guests in for the evening, don't raise your hand now, but just ask yourself, how many times do you invite a guest over without saying, what do you drink? And when you say, what do you drink, you're not talking about coffee, milk, or tea. You're talking about an alcoholic beverage of some kind. Why is it that we seemingly can't enjoy an evening without an alcoholic beverage? Why do we have to have something which kind of loosens us up, relieves some of the inhibitions, relieves us of some of the tension before we can enjoy ourselves? And maybe we need to take a good look at what's so important in our own personal life or culture that we've always got to have at least four or five beers in the box that are cooling and five or six different liquors in the cabinet. How many of you, for example, go to church functions? Maybe even seminary, I don't know. And you can't have a seminary function, and I don't know anything about it, so don't tell me, if a faculty function, without having what do they call it, a cocktail hour, a moment of, what was the one I heard just the other day? Of an attitudinal change hour. You know, that's ridiculous from my perspective. See? I don't think we need that. And I think it's unfortunate we get to the place where we can't seem to have a function, whatever the function happens to be, without first having some drinks. And I think we foster that kind of a situation in our parishes and our cultures. You know, people invite you over. The first time they invite you over, they're a little embarrassed about it. They've got to kind of check you out. Well, my first parish was in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma was a dry state. And I remember the first time one of my members invited me over and said, "Well, Pastor, would you care for a drink?" Almost like, "Well, I know it's illegal. You know, we're not supposed to have booze in Oklahoma." But he did. You know, he'd been over to Missouri, brought a bottle back with him. You know, what's so important? Why do we have to do something that we can't start the evening without doing something which is illegal, or having a drink in a state which is still dry? I remember when I was a student at the SEM, I was went home for the summer, and they happened to have the district pastoral conference at my home church. And you know what my job was that summer? I was responsible for keeping the beer cool in the big, they had a big stock tank out there behind the church with beer in it. My job was to keep that place filled with beer at a pastoral conference. Well, at that time I thought, hey, that's really neat. Well, today there's no way I'd do it. No way. Yeah.
What we expect from it and the attitude that we have towards it.
Right. I think all of us individually ought to investigate our own attitude toward my personal use of alcohol.
Perhaps related to that question, do you have any knowledge about the rate of casualties among clergy in this country related to alcoholism?
Now, I'm not sure what you mean by casualties. You know, how many become alcoholic? Well, it must be very high because the clergy is ranked with right up at the number one professional group with alcoholism, with the medical profession and clergy. So I can't say how many. Well, they estimate 1 out of 10. Yeah, that's a pretty high rate, isn't it? You know, look around here, how many we got in here? 100 people? 10 of you are alcoholic, or going to be. You know, that's not very nice. Question back there. Yeah.
What about the person, is there any physiological disorders like high blood pressure or something that might cause like a person who would normally say, well, I only have 2 drinks, but don't take 2 drinks.
Okay, let me correct one thing. If I said that you can metabolize more, that's not what I intended to say. There's no way that I can speed up or increase the rate of metabolism. That's a fixed situation. What of an average? Okay.
Some people become alcoholics themselves.
Oh yeah. All right. Yeah.
But a person, are there people who for some reason will not metabolize it fast enough?
Well, there are a number of things that contribute to the rate of metabolism. Whether you drank, for example, on a full stomach or an empty stomach, the emotional state of mind that you're in at the time that you drink. The amount of tolerance that you built up, the age at which you started drinking. I was going to come back to that, if I can just interject. Remember I said a while ago, we say on average it takes from 8 to 10 years for the male to become the alcoholic. And we say, well, how come these kids are alcoholic at age 8, 9, 10, 12, average age of our kids is 15? Because almost without exception, and I can't remember the last time we had a pure alcoholic or drug addict among our adolescents. When you begin to mix the two, and remember our kids are coming in on an average of 5 different chemicals, that the one chemical potentiates the other. So, for example, let's say Charlie's got 2 parts of beer and I got 2 parts of alcohol, or of pot, marijuana, and we say, well, that only makes four parts. Uh-uh. Doesn't work that way. It'll be 8, 16, 32, 64. There's no predictability. And so these kids are using multiple drugs, and they move through this period within a year and a half from their onset of the use of chemicals until they become full-blown addicted, chemically dependent people. And we're seeing that with anybody who starts drinking, we're seeing that out about under 22 years of age, they will go through that cycle much more quickly than if you start, let's say, at age 25 or even 30 beyond. Now we see the converse happen particularly have studied this with the females, the female who doesn't start drinking until she's past 45 will also go through that whole addictive cycle within about 2 years, where normally it takes 6 to 8 years. Now, don't ask me why. We don't know. Physiologically, pharmacologically, we don't know why yet. But we're seeing it happen often enough now. We're saying, okay, this we can say is happening. One of the things with the female, for example, we're seeing that grief has a lot to do with the onset of chemical dependence in the female. Not only grief in regard to loss of a spouse, but loss of any interpersonal relationship. And one of the things that we've done a study at our particular hospital on is that we see a high incidence of alcoholism in the female who had what we call premature hysterectomies. Women who have hysterectomy during the childbearing years have a high incidence of alcoholism. I don't know who's next over here. Go ahead. As long as he lives. Right. There's no cure for alcoholism. Same as we would say for a diabetic. A diabetic will be a diabetic until the day they die. We refer to them as recovering alcoholics. Our philosophy is that you will never again be able to do controlled or social drinking. And we emphasize total abstinence. Question over here. They just kind of have to live on what they've got. No, sometimes the wife will say, gee, if I do this and my husband leaves me, I say, well, yeah, you may have to go on welfare. Well, I've never been on welfare, but you may have to go on welfare. But we have to, again, we have to help them understand, okay, maybe that you're going to have to go out and borrow some money. That may be realistic. On the other hand, if you do nothing, I can guarantee that the man's going to lose his job and he's going to lose his health and he's going to die. Then what are you going to do? You're playing some Russian roulette in this business, and I recognize that. But to do nothing is to guarantee defeat. So let's try something. The thing which we at this point say has been most successful, we may save a few. Yeah.
I'm concerned at the beginning of this lecture, you said that alcoholism, and you didn't really define it, but you said it was a sin problem. And you also said that it's an illness. And I'm real concerned about this making this differentiation here. To what extent and how do we as pastors try to get the message across that their salvation is not going to depend on whether they are alcoholic or not? And how do we deal with the person who seemingly most difficult problem at the time is that they're afraid that their faith is being ruined, or that they don't have faith because they're an alcoholic, or that they can't be saved. And maybe they, in preaching the gospel to them, they seem to be quite not satisfied, but comfortable, let's say, in living with their illness as long as their sin has been washed away.
I think as long as they're still drinking, number one, they won't feel that way at all. There's another thought I had. It just slipped my mind. There's a comment I was going to react to the first thing you've mentioned. Oh, even though we say it's an illness, and I don't care which illness you or I might have, we all have a responsibility to do something about that illness, right? If, for example, let's say you have a heart problem, but in spite of the heart problem, you're out here scooping snow like a madman. That's not being very responsible, is it? So you fall over, you die of a coronary, you say, yeah, but look what he's doing. He was scooping the snow for everybody. Does that relieve you of the responsibility? Nor does it for the alcoholic.
What about the analogy? If alcoholism is something that you live with all of your life, now this may be a weak analogy, but leprosy is an incurable disease too. What if someone tries to fall in this type of argumentation?
Okay, even the leper does what he can, right?
I don't know. Well,
I don't either. But I mean, if the man knows about the stories that we read about the lepers in the New Testament, apparently they came and asked for help, didn't they? Okay, that was their way of dealing with their responsibility. The alcoholic finally has to get to the point where he says, hey, I need some help. Because I don't think we can just relieve them by saying, well, you're alcoholic, there's nothing you can do about it. Yeah, he can do something about it. He can accept the help that's available to him.
Maybe one more.
Okay. Or that I'm not going to take my insulin.
Yeah, or yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to just quickly mention several resources that I think you might be interested in. These two are written by the same man, Duane Mayo. No More for the Road. And this other one, You and the Alcoholic in Your Home, are two excellent texts which I would recommend. And here's a real little one if you don't want to have a big book. It's a little cheaper. It's entitled Professional Educational Pastoral Care for Alcoholism. It's in one in a series of four that's put out by Hazleton. It's an excellent little text. You might want to stop and take a look at it or get it on the library shelf, something like that. Thank you very much. I'll see some of you maybe this afternoon.